Welcome everyone to the Palm Beach chapter of the Federalist Society. I'm Manny Farage, Vice President of the chapter. Mark Miller sends his regrets, but he's in trial in Ohio today, so he couldn't make it. Our hosts for today is the law firm of Gunster, and Greg Schwinghammer, one of the partners here in the West Palm Beach office of Gunster, is going to say a few quick words. Please welcome Greg.
Hi, I'm going to say very few words, just say welcome. My partner, Senator George Lemieux, wanted to be here and had to cancel yesterday with depositions that came up somehow in an emergency, and our managing shareholder couldn't be here, so I'm Plan C. Welcome, I'm out of the firm. I've started going to Federalist Society events in 1993 when I started law school, and very excited to have a Federalist Society event at the firm. This is great. We hope we're able to do this kind of thing again, and thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
A few housekeeping announcements and dignitaries that we want to recognize. We have several judges here from the 4th DCA, and please hold your applause to the very end. From the 4th DCA, we have Judge Alan Forst, Judge Jonathan Gerber, Judge Mark Klingensmith, Judge Jeffrey Kuntz, and Judge Spencer Levine. From the 19th Circuit, we have Judge Janet Kroom, Judge Kathleen Roberts, and Judge Darren Steele. From the 15th Circuit, we have Judge Paige Gilman, Judge Minu Sasser, Judge Ed Artel. And from the 11th Circuit, I think the 11th Circuit wins the award today for the longest drive, we have Judge Lisa Walsh. Please welcome them all. Let's get right into it and talk about our speaker for today. Bill McCollum, many of us know him well, is a partner in the D.C. office of Dentons. And he is co-chair of the State Attorney General Practice. Is that correct, Bill McCollum?
Correct.
Bill served as the 36th Attorney General for the state of Florida from 2007 to 2011. Many of us will remember during his term he was very aggressive on several fronts, everything from leading the group of state's attorney generals that objected to the Affordable Care Act on the basis of its constitutionality, to seeking claims of those harmed by the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, to fighting Medicare and mortgage fraud. But one of his areas that I don't think he gets enough credit for is Bill was probably one of the first attorneys general in the country to start fighting internet child predators and was very aggressive in that particular fashion. I don't recall any other state attorney general that did that and he led that group. In addition to his work as one of the members of Florida's cabinet, Bill is also a representative in the U.S. House of Representatives for 20 years. From 1981 to 2001, representing the 8th Congressional District, which is now the 5th. Do I have
it's
that
all
right?
Changed.
The Greater Orlando area.
That's right.
It's been redistricted a couple of times. And he served on the Judiciary, Banking, and Intelligence Committees, amongst other committees that he served on. Bill is very modest about everything that he's done, but most of us do know that he was 5th in line in the House, and was one of the House leaders, including being one of the managers of the Iran-Contra House investigation and also one of the managers of the President Clinton impeachment matter. In addition to that, Bill also served in the United States Navy from 1969 to 1972 and was and actually finished with the rank of commander?
Correct.
And if he hasn't done even more yet, Bill has also worked in multiple public service jobs, including one of my favorites. He served on the boards of the James Madison Institute in Tallahassee. He also served on the board of directors of the state university system, education system for the state of Florida, and also the Enterprise Florida board. And finally, if that isn't enough, one of the things that you can tell what Bill is about is despite everything that he's done and the fact that he works for in the D.C. office of one of the largest firms in the world, I think eighth largest in the world, Bill has never forgotten his hometown roots. Bill is still a member of the Orlando Kiwanis Club. So that gives you an indication what Bill is like. Please join me in welcoming a great American, a great Florida citizen, Bill McCullough.
Let me tell you this. I am so excited about being with the Federalist Society today because I work with the Federalist Society a lot. The things that this organization has stood for and done ever since it was founded have been absolutely incredibly important to the roots of our country and keeping the judicial system and going the way it should go, on the right track, as we'd say, towards the kind of things that many of you being in the judiciary can appreciate, where judges actually shouldn't be making law. They should be basically following the law and doing the best you can to follow the Constitution of the United States the way it is and the way it was intended to be. So I have a couple of reasons to bring this subject up to you and why I'm here today to talk about climate change litigation specifically. I have as a client, so full disclosure, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Institute for Legal Reform. They've been my client ever since I was Attorney General of Florida when I walked out. And primary reason for that, I get to a lawyer's dream in this case. First of all, no Florida law firm wanted me to establish this practice in their firm, a state attorney general practice. It's very common now, but back then it wasn't, and I had this creature that they couldn't quite envision it, but Denton's did. And my first client was Institute for Legal Reform because when I was Attorney General of Florida, I created what's now called TPAC, Transparency in Private Attorney Contracting, and got a bill after a couple of tries called through the legislature that requires the Attorney General of our state in hiring outside contingency fee lawyers to follow certain transparency rules, and the fees are limited but not unreasonably so, so that we didn't have a tobacco light settlement in the future, which Governor Childs at the time, you may remember, was shocked. My law school, the Levin Law School, is named after Mr. Levin, who, of course, is a very famous attorney in Pensacola, still living. We're thankful for the money, but the reality is that many of the law firms received a huge bonanza because those cases were settled without their having to ever go to trial, as you know. But anyway, I was hired to carry on to help them enact this same law in other states, and we've done about 20 states since I've been out, and I'm going to testify in the legislature and all, so that's a pretty cool thing to do. And the Federalist Society is related to that, and I'm going to get to that in just a second. The other thing is I'm currently chairman of the Republican State Leadership Committee, which you probably have never heard of. It is a 527 that came about after the McCain-Feingold law, and it was done because there can't be any federal dollars raised at the RNC or the DNC to participate and give back to state races. That's a little known fact. So this is a 527, independent of the party, and I've chaired the board now. This will be the third election cycle. And one of the things under there, besides trying to grow and maintain control of state legislative bodies and a number of other electeds in the state level, statewide office holders, we're the only organization politically involved in our party in judicial races. Now, but we don't get involved, so judges don't worry about it here in Florida. But we are involved in state Supreme Court races in states that actually have partisan Supreme Court races. And some of the bigger ones do, like Pennsylvania. When I first got aboard, we got our clocks cleaned. There must have been $10 or $20 million spent to elect judges that were openly campaigning, these candidates were, for three seats on the state Supreme Court. If they were elected, they were going to throw out the redistricting plan in that state for Congress, which they proceeded to do. Okay? But I don't know that ethically we think that was such a hot idea. I doubt if any judge campaigned in Florida on that or any other political issue, that would be, I would assume that would be frowned upon by our ethics at the Florida Bar. So we got very involved in, most recently, working with the Federalist Society for the meager sum, in this case, of $1.3 million about 2 weeks ago. There was an election for a state Supreme Court justice in Wisconsin in a 4-3 Republican versus Democrat, balanced Republican at that time, seat. And the other side had already raised, by the time we got involved, we didn't raise that money, by the way, Federalist Society very involved with us on it, until the last 2.5 weeks before the election. The candidate we had was the former general counsel of the governor, Scott Walker. He'd been an appellate court judge in between. for 3 or 4 years, but he couldn't raise money. And the Democrats, Holder and those guys, raised millions. I'm serious, millions of dollars for the other person who campaigned and was highly favored. And our political director decided there was a path to victory, and here's how we're going to do it. And we were able to raise that money, and we won that race. Those are the kind of things that endear me to the with folks who are doing what you support to be done. Now, let me get to the bottom line of this. We have things like TPAC, litigation funding issues. Litigation is amok in this country in many, many ways. I was a trial lawyer. I grew up in the trial. I don't have any problem with that at all. I did both plaintiffs and defense work. And somebody said, well, you're a Navy JAG. Yeah, but I'm not talking about that. After I got out of the JAG Corps, that's what I did. So I have a pretty good idea about that. I don't want to put anybody out of business. But I do think that some things are kind of outrageous. After TPAC occurred, Transparency Private Attorney Contract, after we began to make everything public about hiring contingency fee attorneys, the attorneys generals, many of whom in the country were hiring, and they still do hire some outside counsel, no longer were going to pay 25 and 33% fees. So, for example, General Bondi does have outside counsel for the opioid case. Do you know what the fees are for that that she's paying? Anybody here got any idea what the fees are in the contract, which she, you know, she negotiated with 3 or 4 of these really big national plaintiffs' law firms? 3.5%. 3.5%. Now, it should be 3.5% of a big amount. But that's what they think will be a big amount. Who knows what it'll be? But still, it's not 25%. Anyway, the constraints that went on, and there are very few who hire contingency fee attorneys any longer unless they're small states, and they absolutely have to do that. And when they do, the fees are not anywhere near where they were. So what happened once that occurred is the plaintiff's bar, the organized part of it, the ones with, not everybody's the same, but the ones that bring these big lawsuits like that, decided we're going to go out and we're going to go get the cities and the counties involved. We're going to find somebody else to bring the lawsuit. We're going to find other ways to do this. We have more lawsuits today going on in this country with opioids, with cities and counties involved, and in the climate change area, and you start looking at the complexity of it, than we've ever had. And not to mention the regular lawsuits that attorneys general like me or General Ashley, General Moody would bring. It's just an enormous, a lot of those kind of suits. So that brings me to this subject. If we look at the proliferation, and by the way, the problem with the cities and counties bringing these suits of the opioid matters is just pure policy. It's not just the fact that they're out there bringing them. It's the difficulty of selling them. I've had major plaintiffs' law firms involved in the opioid case, used to dealing with the states, and they'd like to get to a settlement. There's going to be no settlement until there's some trials, because the big companies, maybe Purdue's going to settle, but the big companies that are involved in this, the other ones, a lot of them, for reasons that are pretty arguably sound, say, we're not at fault, we're not liable, and we're not going to pay out big bucks and settle with all of these cases out here until we resolve some of this. And there's no way for a judge in Ohio to put them all together and force it. He's tried, but he's not going to succeed. But then you get to this climate change litigation, and you look at all of what's happened with it. And before I get into it, I've got to get to the crux of what it's about. The basis upon that and many other cases that come out of the cities and counties, and to some extent the states, are based on a public nuisance argument. Some of you, again, may know what that's all about, but public nuisance wasn't a big deal for a long time. It traces its history back to 16th century England, when there was a decision made in what's basically criminal situations where somebody acts criminally against an individual's property to let there be some kind of relief. The idea of having abatement of whatever the nuisance was never in that part of the law. The king held that power for years. And when it came to America as part of our common law, that's the way it came. And in the first restatement of torts, that's the way it was. It was only in the second restatement of torts that we get the environmental groups coming in and lobbying, even though Prosser had written it just like it was in the first. And he's the one who wrote this provision on public nuisance in the second restatement. They came in and lobbied the various parties involved, the ALI, and got language in there about unreasonable things that people could do and cause a problem for individual with harm, and allowed individuals, if they were suing as a class, to seek abatement as well. For a while, that didn't make much difference. But it was brought up in asbestos cases, but never really got anywhere. It was brought up a bit in the tobacco lawsuits that the attorneys general's file. They didn't go to trial. And the only case it was ever presented in, the judge ruled in some motion that it didn't apply, that they couldn't go with that argument. But it was there, and big money came as a settlement. And then along came the cases involving lead paint and the Love Canal and big chemical companies. And it evolved to the point that chemicals, like in the Love Canal and later other things, manufacturers were being held responsible in state laws, particularly under public nuisance doctrine, that there was no need to even prove fault. All you had to do, the causation was limited. Go back, you have a manufacturer, the end result, it's almost like strict liability. The end result is bad things happen to the environment, and you're responsible for that. Well, today, that's the basis upon which these climate change lawsuits hang, most of what exists out there. I don't know how much you're following this at all, but because you're here in South Florida, because the Fort Lauderdale City Commission heard from Earth Rights International last fall, and because there's a lot of talk about how they are being lobbied, as is Miami, Miami Beach, and other cities, to get involved with these lawsuits, I suspect you're at least more aware than maybe they would be aware in my hometown, Orlando. But the crux of these suits are all the same. They're cookie-cutter things. There are things that have a very serious ramification in terms of where we go and how we deal with these. And it's organized. There is a purpose in it. The people who bring it, and I debated a professor up at FSU, and it wasn't really a debate, it was a very friendly discussion. But he is from California, I presume a liberal professor, but nice enough guy. And he really didn't care about the lawsuit, he cares about the end product. We need to bring world attention and pressure for climate change. We need to come and get this to happen. It's not happening, and this is a way to do something. And that's really what this is about, all except for the lawyers. The lawyers are looking to make money, okay? And if they can hit it big, they can make money. Now, having said that, there are major lawsuits pending today that I think ultimately at least one of them or some consolidated version going to the United States Supreme Court for this resolved. They're pending in the First Circuit. They're pending in the Second. We're talking about Federal Circuit Court of Appeals. They're pending in either District Court or in the Court of Appeals already. The First, the Second, the Fourth, the Ninth, and the Tenth. That's a lot of them. And if you look at where we are with these cases, the leading case, I suppose, that gets the most notoriety was Oakland and other parties, against BP, the big oil companies, Exxon, etc. The idea being that if you sued these guys, the fault lies in the fact they're producing oil and selling oil and marketing oil and promoting oil, all the while they knew, or at least they have reports, that burning fossil fuels contributes to CO2, it contributes to, you know, the greenhouse effect, that contributes to sea level rise, or i.e. climate change. That's the argument. The legal part of it comes to the fact that the question is, where is the liability? And they do, you know, throw out a number of theories. Some of them have negligence in it, some of them have strict liability, et cetera. But the primary, and trespasses in some of them, and you sue a whole lot of big companies, not just BP and Exxon, you got Sun, and you got ConocoPhillips, and depends on which lawsuit, how many of them are in which, but there are all the big boys are in there. And then you base this suit on public nuisance. That's the crux of it. And the argument is very clear. So where are we with all these cases? The judge in Oakland, in the Oakland case, California judge, Democrat appointed, believes in climate change. He's not a climate denier. He buys all of it, writes his opinion out, great detail, and then he concludes one thing. And by the way, he denied remand to the states. They did have a motion, and most of that is what's going to be litigated. they think they should have a right to try it in state court. Why do they want to be it in state court? Because there's an American Electric Power Company case versus Connecticut, where the United States Supreme Court ruled a few years ago that in the federal arena, that there is a displacement of federal common law, which public nuisance is derived from common law, and there is federal common law. It displaces that in the sense that the Clean Air Act authorized EPA regulations that then displaced the right to bring a public common law public nuisance action. And because of that, that's an onerous burden to get around, and they want to apply state law. So everything's kind of debated, if you want to get in the weeds over this, on whether it should be in the states and whether state law can apply as opposed to federal law, or, you know, some still try to argue how to get around it at the federal level, but it's very, very difficult to do. So Judge Alsup, in his opinion, which I'm not going to read to you, but I may read you a quote later, has came down with a ruling dismissing it all. He ruled no remand, and I'm dismissing it. He said, you know, I don't buy your argument that there can be no federal preemption. And I believe it's pretty clear that if you're looking at this from the standpoint of displacement, as far as the law, which is interesting, if the product was produced in the United States, if it was oil being produced here, being burned here, and fired and whatever went out, then that would be subject for the displacement argument. But in this case, we're dealing with international, and we're dealing with oil that's produced overseas. We're dealing with pollutants that come wherever they come, and they're just one of many people who are applying it. And consequently, it's totally preempted by the simple fact that this has to be federal. It is international. It's a division, as we talked about some of us earlier, between the powers. And whose power is this? And this judge says it should be the power of the executive. It should be congressional primarily, or executive. You either have diplomatic or you're going to have congressional action. It's not for me to decide. And the distinctions that are there, the fine points of what public nuisance law now requires about weighing the factors between what's really bad and harm that occurs by whatever acts are alleged and the good public utility, which he says is really great and has been over the years. It made the Industrial Revolution possible and makes our lives and our ability to have the kind of lifestyles we have in the West and elsewhere possible. That it's pretty clear where he comes down, but he said, that's not for me to decide. That's not for the courts to decide. That's really a question that should be left in the political arena. Now, that's on appeal, as you might imagine. That's on appeal to the Ninth Circuit. They've had briefs filed, and they're getting ready to do oral arguments in that case before long. The other case in California is San Mateo. San Mateo had a different result. The judge there, in that case, decided to remand it to the states. He said, I don't buy anything that Judge Alsup said. It's all going back to the states, and you're going to get it. Because he said the preemption doctrine is very narrow. And he said they're boxes. He used the term boxes. They're little boxes over here. And you actually have to have a federal statutory explicit preemption of state law in order for you to be able to say this is a federal matter. Otherwise, it's the state matter. And I don't see this here. You can't see it in the Clean Air Act where the states, and the state has the right to sue internationally or anywhere else because it's not prohibited unless there's a statutory prohibition. So this, you can see how this is getting set up for the U.S. Supreme Court pretty quickly. There is no statutory restriction in that regard. There is none. And the judges, there are others, by the way, rule on this point, will say they're not. And then they will say there, but there is an inherent federal preemption because of the nature of what this is internationally. So that's where that one is. And that, by the way, the remand order is being appealed, and they briefed it. And that's going to the Ninth Circuit as well. So that's on its way. It's already there. And there, you know, that was not long before being heard, too. Ninth Circuit's pretty liberal, so we can't count on that one, okay? But anyway, I think that's fascinating. Washington State, in the meantime, has one. King County, Washington. That case, they stayed pending the decision of the Ninth Circuit on the Oakland case. But it got to the remand level as well. Then Boulder, Colorado has one. You read about it. Boulder's been in the papers down here because I read the stuff. Boulder has a case. That's interesting because there's no sea level rise in Boulder. But Boulder has a lot of other things they put in for damages. You don't have to read that. It's a fun complaint to read. That case is just at the remand level as well right now. And that one, of course, is the good news is they're not in the ninth. I was thinking Colorado was, but I looked it up. They're not. And they're in the 10th, I guess it is. I don't know how they rule, but just by the states that are in the 10th, I suspect that we have a better shot there. And then there's New York City. That's the other one, where the judge in New York City threw the case out and dismissed it as well. So you have a New York judge and a California judge, hardly conservatives, who've thrown the cases out. They're the two that have dismissed it, saying there's no cause of action here. In that case, interestingly enough, you've got the attorneys generals of New York involved. I should say the attorney general of New York involved. You also have a lot of, I mean, that's a hugely pled case. And that was brought originally in federal court. They didn't bring it in state court. But their argument is the federal court is obligated to apply state law of public nuisance in the absence of the ability to use the federal common law of public nuisance. And he said, hogwash, that's not true. But they've got all kinds of people arguing. That's the crux of a lot of this. And the reason you can't use the federal common law is because displacement. And because it really doesn't apply, as Judge Alsop said, in the situations where you involve the oil and the product, if you manufactured, if you want to call it that, being produced in, you know, Siberia or wherever, as opposed to being produced in New York State. It's an interesting case. That one, as well, is on appeal, and it's obviously going the same type of thing going on there as going on with Oakland, except that's in the Second Circuit. Then you have a case involving Rhode Island. That one is currently stayed at the moment, waiting for a little decision. Oh, it's on remand. That's a remand again. Waiting for a hearing on remand. Baltimore also is waiting on a hearing on remand. They haven't yet had it. We don't know where it's going. And there are several more in a similar situation. What we see here, though, is this huge argument being set up about state versus federal and where we go from here. So I just wanted to tell you that I am one who doesn't think this should be happening this way. I think these lawsuits are going to be lost by the plaintiffs. I cannot imagine ultimately this Supreme Court not ruling that way. I've read it in great detail in a number of these cases. It's fun to read the pleadings. Now, you don't have time to do that for practicing in real law. And I don't either, except that this is part of my job. Now, I can't bill them for all the time I spend reading this. So don't worry, I haven't billed anybody for preparing to come down here. But I did go ahead and look on the web. And if you want to go, there are several sites. Just type in climate change. You don't have to go LexisNexis. Just type in climate change and litigation, or climate litigation. I just type in climate litigation. And you'll see their dockets that come right up, and you can just tap on them, and you can look at the pleadings, every pleading in any case remotely related. The last one I'll mention to you is the fact that, I'm well aware that Exxon 3 years ago sued the attorneys generals of New York and Massachusetts. So you wonder where those states are in some, this is the states in this case, they're trying to get involved. They were doing SIDS, or as some of you worked in my office know, it's our investigative subpoenas, trying to get information out of ExxonMobil and others, but particularly ExxonMobil. And ExxonMobil is just stalling, saying, no way we're going to give you anything internally. And they argue it's a free speech issue. You are encroaching on our free speech because we know what you're planning, because we've gone out and we've said that oil is good, that the climate change argument is bogus, and here's why. I mean, they've been very bold about this, and we've talked publicly about this, and now you want to get all of our internal documents and do discovery. So they went into federal court in Texas. That got eventually transferred to New York State. It's gone through, I can't tell you how many briefs, motions, whatever it is. It's in an appellate stage now as well. But who knows how many more years they'll keep that tied up. But this is, again, moving in a direction which is not very favorable in terms of ultimately prevailing. In my opinion, in this case, probably the AGs are going to prevail. But I don't know that, but I'm just guessing that they will. That's not the main thing about climate change. What I do like, though, is the Office of Resilience and Coastal restoration that Governor DeSantis set up. I think that office is a terrific idea. He did that his first week or so in office. It got a lot of attention again in your paper. I know that because the Orlando paper and the Sun Sentinel are published almost the same paper anymore. And so I read everything you read, pretty much, which is kind of nice. I used to have to subscribe to everything. But I also know that in terms of the compact that's down here, it exists. If you're going to address this, whatever you believe about climate change, and by the way, I'm not arguing this, but just so you know it, there are some very respected meteorologists who are convinced we're entering a new ice age now, and that's based on sunspot activity. I don't know that that's true. Probably it's not, but they are true believers, and they can show you the cycles, and they can take you all through that. That's not to say there isn't carbon emissions, and there might, but we need to be prepared. We need to be prepared for sea level rise because it's happening right now. Okay? And therefore, this idea of being prepared is a good idea, that regardless of your political persuasion or how you view all of this, we ought to be all behind that. And for Florida, there ought to be the whole state involved in it. And there should be whatever resources we need to do to be prepared for the changes that are going to cost us on the coast like this that are going to occur if the warming continues and the sea levels rise for whatever the reason. So that's kind of my view. Now, I'll conclude by telling you something I was going to say at the beginning. George LeBeau is the reason I was Attorney General of Florida. And I'm sorry George wasn't here for me to say that in front of his own law firm and the office here. But George and I have been friends a long time. He supported me when I was running for the U.S. Senate and didn't make it, win those races. And one day I was in Tallahassee. I was just happily practicing law with Baker and Hosteller, idly not doing anything. Well, I was doing something, but not a lot. And I wandered into Charlie Crist's office and to see George, not to see Charlie, to see George. And George is sitting behind his computer, and I guess it was somewhere not very long before qualifying for Attorney General, and he said, you know, there are a lot of people out here talking about this race, but you ought to be running for it. And I said, I'm not sure I ever want to do that. And he said, well, look what I do. And he really was running the office. Let's face it. Charlie was out running for governor always, and George was running that office. I don't know, George wouldn't say that, but he was. And so I got to really think about it. He took me through what it does. Some of you began to work for the office. So I credit George with giving me the most pleasurable job. I enjoyed being a congressman. Look, it was exciting. It was different. The Almanac of American Politics said your column's involved with one controversy after another. I guess I'm still doing that. I'm talking about climate change, right? But I really enjoyed being Attorney General. You could get things done there. We had the program that you mentioned a minute ago, and I thank you for that introduction. I saw one Attorney General just a week ago. I can't remember where it is, somewhere up northeast, actually had one of these programs of going after internet child predators. I encouraged General Moody to renew that program. It still exists, but it's not being publicized very well, and we don't have any police officers, if you will, at the Attorney General's office doing that. They all were sent back to FDLE, and none of them who went back to FDLE are doing that work right now. So it's very difficult. The education part is still being done. But I credit George with that, and I just want to thank you. I want to thank you all for being active with the Federalist Society. Thank you for what you do that influences outcomes that I hope and I believe will help us in the future and our grandkids be able to live in a free society and have individual liberty and opportunity protected, and capitalism prevail. The free marketplace is the only reason we're sitting here having a good meal today. And anybody who doesn't understand it, all they got to do is take a look at Venezuela. And I believe that what you do makes a huge difference. The court decisions, all that we do about electing judges, I mean about electing legislators, whoever's running for legislature, I'm all for it. I'm in there all the time helping with that. But it can be totally dismissed in a moment if you have the wrong people in the wrong judicial positions in the wrong states, and I can assure, or at the United States Supreme Court level. So we are fortunate that this organization has grown over the years and is as strong today as it is, and you are the reason for that. So thank you for inviting me out. God bless you.
I know we have some folks that need to get back to court, but General McCollum has a couple of minutes for questions. Do we have any questions?
from the floor?
I got something to quote you if you don't have a question. Yes.
What? I remember reading on recently, wasn't there some sort of children's lawsuit about climate change? Oh, sorry. Wasn't there some sort of, it was publicized like the children's lawsuit against climate change. I think even the Obama administration tried to get it stayed, and the Trump administration tried to get it stayed, and it was denied both times, and it's going to trial.
There may be. There are a lot of lawsuits out there I didn't cite. If you go look at the list, you're going to see that fishermen in California have a lawsuit, and there are a bunch of others. But these ones I cited are the ones that have the principal focus for the reasons I said. But I would not want to tell you. If you go up again, just type in climate change, start looking at all the litigation going on out there. And I'm not the expert in every one of them. I don't remember that. Anybody got something else real quick? Yes, sir.
Hi, Robert Mendy. It sounds like a crazy cockamamie lawsuit you got going on here. Sounds like the rule 11 all day. How does this not become something that you can just start suing anybody and everybody over? Like, oh, it's a plastic straw that they could get in the ocean. Now let's sue the plastic straw manufacturers and tablecloth manufacturers. Oh, you got to cut down plants to make the cotton. So, you're taking out oxygen.
Well, that's why the change in the restatement of torts, the second restatement, is so fundamentally important. And I chose to give you a talk today. I spent a lot of time at FSU and I learned better and actually trying to quote law. And heck, I may be a lawyer, but I'm not talking to the judges and the appellate court to argue my case. I'm just wanting to present. But the fundamental problem goes back to that. Now, that's not likely to get changed by us, but we can restrain the courts and hopefully have the right judges will do that, that you've gotten there and the Federalist Society have a role in the U.S. Supreme Court, ultimately. And I do believe there'll be a conflict between the circuits when it comes out at the end of the day. And if it's not, it's still such a great public interest, I can't imagine that it wouldn't make it to the Supreme Court. And that, whatever their decision would be on one of these cases, I think will be restraining. Let me read you something real quick. I said I didn't want to read it. This is not a normal thing from a judge's. This isn't what he based his decision on exactly, but it's close to it. This was Judge Alsop in the Oakland case, and he said, with respect to balancing the social utility, which is what in public nuisance is a standard of unreasonableness, whether you have that at the state level or the federal, it doesn't matter. With respect to balancing the social utility against the gravity of the anticipated harm, it is true that carbon dioxide released from fossil fuels has caused and will cause global warming. So he concludes that, whether you do or I do or not, but he concludes that. But against that negative, we must weigh this positive. Our industrial revolution and the development of our modern world has literally been fueled by oil and coal. Without those fuels, virtually all our monumental progress would have been impossible. All of us have benefited. Having reaped the benefits of that historic progress, would it really be fair to now ignore our own responsibility in the use of fossil fuels and place the blame for global warming on those who supplied what we demanded? Is it really fair, in light of those benefits, to say that the sale of fossil fuels was unreasonable? He comes down and makes a legal decision at the end. But he threw that in gratuitously. But the arguments they're making is that the sale, that's something I didn't try to get all the weeds on it, but that when somebody tries to pin them down and say, it's being produced abroad, not in your state, what's the connection? They're selling it in my state. They're promoting it in my state. That's the connection to my state. That's the connection to my city. That's the connection to my county. That's the public nuisance that's involved, is that they sold and promoted it and they knew it was causing global warming. And they are the villains in this piece. And even if other people are responsible, they're the deep pockets, they should pay for it. That's the argument. It's wrong, but that's the argument. And the judge's argument, of course, is what I just read. Yes, sir.
Isn't this litigation and everything wrapped up in it, just an end run around the legislature? They're unhappy Congress won't act, they're unhappy the president.
That's right.
The Paris Accord, so judges, please deal with the legislature and the president.
That's precisely right, and a lot of the social litigation is coming from that, and I call it social. It's not talking about, women's right or anything like that, but it's social in the sense it's environmental, but it's a cause. Again, you have the professionals will bring the lawsuits and making money off of them. But behind them, promoting this, go look and see who's involved with Earth Resources International. That's an interesting thing to look up yourself. I'm not going to tell you all the names, but you're going to recognize them. They're all people who are also involved elsewhere in very liberal causes in terms of the environment. And they're trying not just to do climate change, but a lot of other things. The same Ocasio-Cortez type is involved, except with big money and deep pockets.
You almost ruined my lunch by talking about that tobacco so-called litigation where Lawton Childs and Dexter Douglas and Dad the Midas Club back in the day, and they got this huge slush fund. That was the filthiest thing I've ever seen in Florida politics.
That was very bad end result, and I think that's, again, what triggered me creating what I call transparency and private attorney contracting, that legislation. And I'm very proud of that. It works. And we still can have contingency fee suits. We just aren't going to ever have those big fees again in our state like that. Yes, sir?
Is there an abatement component to these lawsuits?
Yes, there is.
Is it to stop selling the product or to stop it being used by people in India or China?
Well, it's to stop. That's a big part of this, too. They don't spell out every detail, but it's essentially to stop doing damage in San Mateo. Stop. And how can you do that if you don't stop the production? But it's, you can't. But they would say just don't sell and don't promote in San Mateo. That's how they're going to define this. Or New York State or Kings County, Washington. Don't sell and don't promote. That's the axis of their legal argument. Sale and promotion. Okay? Production, they try to get away from because they know they're not producing that in San Mateo or Kings County or New York City. They know they're not producing it. They are selling it and promoting it. That's their argument. And of course, the promotion is the part where Massachusetts and New York's attorney generals are out trying to find all the gory details from whatever that they knew that this was happening and it was likely to cause global warming. And they were greedy, oil companies, and same type of argument about, they're trying to make a tobacco case out of it. The very thing we're talking about. And they, I don't believe, will be successful, but they're trying to do that.
What do they need to establish for standing? I mean, can you drive through Oakland and say, look, I took a lot of deep breaths and I'm suffering. And the other question I have is, isn't this really just kind of a battle of the experts? Like you'll have one side saying, this is what's occurring because of the use, promotion of oil, and the other side saying, Judge, this is not affecting the environment. There is no such thing as global warming.
Well, we don't really see much argument pushback on the substance of this, but in all the pleadings are cookie cutter, they're boilerplate. In other words, take every case I just told you about, and the first, in the middle part, right after the first paragraphs they have to put in there, before they get into making any mention of public nuisance or trespass or whatever else they're going to do, or making the claim on abatement, they're going to tell you all the harms. You ought to read the one on Boulder, Colorado, because you get no sea level rising here, but they're talking about very specific damages, and they've got, in the pleadings, they have graphs, they have studies, they have whatever, and every one of these cases, when they go on appeal, have the same organizations that have amicus briefs. Okay? And the amicus briefs lay out more of that same stuff, almost all of them arguing for global warming and the harm that it's causing to that particular community in very specific ways. And it's financial. I mean, they're really out the dollars. So they have claimed damages. So if you were going to do it here in Fort Lauderdale or Miami, the damage, and by the way, that's another point I didn't make. A lot of these damages are anticipatory. And that's the abatement part. So right now, how can you say what the damages are going to be 20 years from now? They're going to claim you they can, but I don't think they'll win that. But they do make those claims too. We know it's going to be whatever, project it out and try that. But they will very specifically, if you're talking about Fort Lauderdale, you'll be talking about sea level rise. What's that going to do to oceanfront property? What's that going to do to the value of whatever? What are you going to have to do to repair a bridge that you wouldn't have, and you're going to have to build what? That's and they've got the specifics. So there are damages being alleged.
What are they seeking in Colorado?
Oh, in Colorado, they're talking about wind and drought. Dry weather. The weather's changing. It's all about weather in Colorado. Not as much snow anymore, so that they will wind up with damage to their ski resorts and that sort of thing. Lots of that, by the way. Lots of, you know, Boulder's a pretty liberal city. Ever been to Boulder? Actually, I like going to Estes Park. If you want to go out there, Rocky Mountain National Park is great. Who has another one? I actually am an environmentalist. You may not think that, but I am. I'm very pleased with what Ron DeSantis is doing regarding the Everglades. I hope he does more with regard to water. Water is the biggest issue facing our state for the next generation, in my opinion. But environmentalist means one thing to me and maybe you, and it means something entirely different to these guys that are on the radical side of this and wanted to use the courts to go where they can't go, as you pointed out, somebody pointed out, legislatively. They can't get there by the normal means, so they use the courts. Same thing is true for congressional redistricting. The same thing is true for, you know, a lot of things that they're doing is because they are not able to get where they want to go in the political world, which is where this should be resolved. Anybody else got anything? I know I'm taking you right just past the 1 o'clock. In my Kiwanis Club, you mentioned, nobody can go past 1 o'clock. They're out the door. I'm amazed. I had people at the school. I know that. But look how many people stayed until 6 minutes after one. So, listen, I have enjoyed it. I don't get down here as much as I used to. I really like this community in this area. It's beautiful. It's fun. And actually, that's part of what I miss about not being in public life is people. I miss not being in the back room making the decisions, if there is a back room, or in the room is a better way to put it. Not in secret in Florida, because everything's transparent. But I actually miss the people. I miss the interaction. Some of you today I haven't seen in quite a long time. So I hope I get another opportunity, and we'll find some other occasion to come down. Thank you very much. God bless.